6. Nation. Of the German nation. Political influences. Italians and Burgundians identified with the empire to varying degrees, but only the Germans associated it with their nation. Much has been made of the addition of the words of the German nation to the title Holy Roman Empire. Appearing in 1474, this combination was used more frequently after 1512 without becoming the empire's official title, despite numerous later claims to the contrary. Protestants were far more likely than Catholics to add of the German nation when discussing the empire, but even their use was inconsistent. Only 1 in 9 official documents issued after 1560 included any reference to Germany, usually referring simply to the empire. This chapter argues that the absence of a single political center in the empire complicated the definition of German national identity, encouraging several, often antagonistic versions of Germanness by the 18th century. This contributed to the richness of German identity, which was not restricted by linguistic or artistic criteria, but instead was defined primarily politically. Later sections explore how the empire was represented symbolically and how far its other non-German-speaking inhabitants identified with it, as well as demonstrating the continued strength of older, broader political identities relative to narrower, more essentialist concepts of nationalism emerging around 1800. The subsequent description of the empire as simply Germany stems from attempts to trace German history in national terms. Various national birthdays have been suggested, with the events surrounding the first partition of the Carolingian realm being the favorite. The chronicler Nithard recorded the Strasbourg Oath, sworn by Carolingian nobles in 842, in both Old High German and Old French versions. The tripartite division, East Francia, West Francia, Lotharingia, enacted the following year through the Treaty of Verdun, appears to confirm the end of Charlemagne's empire and its replacement by French and German kingdoms. Other historians favor the Treaty of Mersenne from 870, since this redrew the map in a more modern form by dividing most of Lotharingia between the East and West Frankish kingdoms. The extinction of the Eastern Carolingians and their replacement in 919 by the Ottonians was also interpreted later as the true birth of the German monarchy. In this narrative, Otto I's coronation in 962 becomes the start of an entirely new, greater German empire. All of these claims work by projecting later developments deep into the past. For example, Louis the Pious's son, Louis II, who ruled East Francia after 843, only received the sobriquet the German in Heinrich von Bunau's History of the Empire, published in 1739. Louis II was certainly known to contemporaries as Rex Germaniae, King of Germany, while his brother Charles the Bald was Rex Galliae, King of Gaul. But it is unclear what these meant, beyond distinguishing different parts of what many believed was still a common Frankish realm. The West Frankish king Lothar, the penultimate Western Carolingian, attacked Aachen in the summer of 978. Otto II and his wife only just managed to escape. Lothar celebrated his coup by having the imperial eagle on the palace roof turned to face east instead of west. Writers either side of the Rhine interpreted this in partisan terms, displaying a sense of cultural differences, but nonetheless still focusing these on their king in the form of the regnal identities discussed in the previous chapter. The sense of difference did not end references to a broader Frankish heritage, which was invoked by emperors into the 12th century and remained part of most discussions of the empire's identity long after that. The terms Germani, Germans, and Teutonici, Teutons, were not original self-designations, but labels applied by outsiders to the inhabitants of what later became known as Germany. The Romans used Germani to refer to all those northern peoples they did not want to conquer. The term gained renewed currency through its employment by Latin-trained missionaries entering this area from the 7th century. Missionaries also spread the use of the term Teutonici, derived from lingua theodisca, which in turn stemmed from the Old German theot, meaning people, hence those who spoke a local vernacular rather than Latin. In reality, the inhabitants spoke a variety of Indo-European languages, while they saw themselves as distinct tribes or peoples. By then, Western writers were also employing the term Alemanni from the name of the tribe closest to them. In time, this evolved into the French and Spanish words for Germany, Alemagne, Alemannia, while the Alemanni themselves became Swabians. The renewed engagement of northerners in Italian affairs from the mid-10th century, after around 60 years' relative absence, embedded these designations. By 1000, Italians were likely to generalize all northerners as Teutonici. The Ottonians appear to have embraced the label and carried it back over the Alps, where it contributed to the gradual use of the term Regnum Teutonicorum. The concept was politically expedient, enabling both the Ottonians and their Salian successors to disarm potential criticism that they were not really Carolingian Franks by presenting themselves as rulers of all peoples inhabiting the realm north of the Alps and east of the Rhine. To them, the German kingdom was not synonymous with the empire, which remained greater and included other kingdoms in Italy, Burgundy, and Bohemia. The reduction of the empire to Germany came from the Salians' papal opponents, as Gregory VII sought to belittle Henry IV by reducing him to merely a German king. Without abandoning claims to be emperors of a far greater realm, both the later Salians and the Stauffers found identification with Germany also useful in countering papal actions. The German king and his subjects were equal sufferers at the hands of a perfidious pope, whose excommunication and interdict affected them all. This helps explain why John XXII went a step further in his attempts to belittle Louis IV by calling him the Bavarian. The multi-centered character of imperial governance inhibited the kind of focused regnal identities forming around English, French, Polish, or Hungarian monarchs. Henry II and Charlemagne were canonized in 1146 and 1165 respectively, without either of them gaining universal recognition as German or imperial patron saints. Writers in the empire favored strength in numbers, with the empire's numerous saints and political centers as its distinguishing characteristic. Nonetheless, the wider sense of the empire continued to become more closely associated with German identity after 1250. This requires qualification before proceeding, since it should not be misconstrued as arguing there was a single, wider Germanic civilization based either politically on the empire or on alleged commonalities of language, law, or economic forms. It is also a paradox that the decades between 1251 and 1311, when German kings were not crowned emperors, were those of the growing association between the empire and German identity. The Stauffer's demise stimulated discussions of German identity at a time when it was also becoming clearer that Europe was subdividing into kingdoms, each associated with a distinct people. Writers were concerned that Germans should not lose imperial prestige while their kings were unwilling or unable to be crowned emperor. What later generations interpreted as weakness actually strengthened the ideological associations between German identity and the empire. A relatively distant king emperor could be attractive as a monarch who did not impose heavy burdens on his subjects. The absence of a single stable political core freed the monarchy from being tied to any one part of Germany, enabling all regions to identify with it. This explains the growing interest in ideas of imperial translation of the empire as inheritor of ancient Rome, ideas that were disentangled from papal critique and employed to assert that Germans were distinct from Europeans through their association with the imperial title and its pan-Christian mission. These discussions already elaborated all the tropes that found full expression 2 centuries later in humanist writings. Germans demonstrated their virtues through their martial prowess, amply justifying their claim to be Christendom's defenders. In this way, the concept of imperial translation became the empire's myth of origins, substituting for the more focused stories elsewhere, like the myths around the Goths in Sweden or the Sarmatians in Poland. Language. Association with the empire defined Germany and German identity politically, enabling both to continue including peoples of other languages and cultures. Likewise, electoral status made the archbishops of Mainz, Cologne, and Trier all Germans, despite their possessions being located in what was, historically, ancient Gaul. The humanist Sebastian Münster's Cosmographia, published in Basel in 1544, presented a historical geographical description of Germany in which the word Deutschland was synonymous throughout with the empire, regardless of the language on the ground. Johann Jakob Moser argued that French and Italian-speaking Savoy belongs to Germany through its incorporation within the German kingdom dating back to 1361, and he also used German as shorthand for imperial. Germany remained a land of many languages, while political and linguistic boundaries never aligned. Some 9th-century texts were written in Frankish, like the Fulda translation of the Gospel, that became the basis for the 6,000-line Heiland poem recounting Jesus' life in Old Saxon. Nonetheless, Latin remains the dominant written language until the emergence of Middle High German in the 12th century. Eastward migration and conquest greatly complicated matters, with the number of dialects identified subsequently rising from 12 between 1150 and 1250 to 18 across the following 250 years. Notably, the spread of New High German northwards from southern Germany after 1350 displaced Northern Low German, which developed subsequently in the northwest as Dutch, a word itself, of course, deriving from Deutsch. The linkage between Germany and the empire was reinforced by the gradual displacement of Latin by German as an administrative language from the 13th century, about 2 centuries before English replaced either Latin or French for political and administrative communication in England. The public peace proclaimed at Mainz in 1235 was the first significant constitutional document issued for the entire empire in German. By 1300, German was increasingly used for charters, reflecting the larger number of laity holding office rather than clergy proficient in Latin. German accounted for half the documents produced by the Upper Bavarian Chancellery across the first 25 years after its adoption in 1290. The use of Latin was reduced to technical and legal terms, except in Habsburg administration, where it continued to be used to communicate with Hungarians for the next 4 centuries. The administrative use of German helped to standardize it well ahead of the language reforms promoted by 18th-century intellectuals. The numerous lordly and civic authorities between Nuremberg, Eger, Würzburg, and Regensburg began corresponding in a common South German form after the mid-14th century. This was adopted by the Imperial Chancellery in 1464, and thereafter by territorial governments like that of Electoral Saxony. The advent of printing around 1450 accelerated this, because imperial institutions rapidly exploited the new media to distribute laws, decisions, and information across the empire. Luther's famous German Bible had to be retranslated into Low German to reach the Baltic coast readers. But the imperial chancery style was already adopted by North German territorial administrations around 1500, thanks to their communication with the Reichstag and other institutions. This contrasts with the problems of standardizing Italian. Despite the identification of the Tuscan dialect with Italian high culture since the Renaissance, and its subsequent dissemination through printed literature, it failed to establish itself as the predominant form until official measures imposed after Italian unification in 1861. Other languages in the empire withered through failing to establish a written form. Prussian, Kashubian, and Polabian all died out by 1700, though Sorbian continues to the present day, thanks to its use by the Lusatian estates, which adopted it as the official language of Protestant education in their territory. Romance disappeared in the Vorarlberg, but survived in neighboring Rhaetia. Likewise, Slovene died out in Styria, but developed a written form in parts of Hungary, as had Yiddish already much earlier. Czech was written from the 13th century and thrived from the 1390s, thanks to its use in imperial administration under the Luxembourgs and subsequent place within Hussitism. Thus, while German was linked to the empire itself was multilingual. The Golden Bull of 1356 specified German, Latin, Upper Italian, and Czech as imperial administrative languages. The imperial chancellery used the language of the intended recipients from about 1370. Although German became the primary language after 1620, the Reichshofrat continued using Italian in its dealings with Imperial Italy. Language was already politically sensitive before the empire standardized official communication. Migration since the 12th century sharpened language and ethnicity as factors shaping identity and demarcating access to resources in the areas of recent Western settlement beyond the Elbe. Subsequent population growth added pressure by the 1320s, when North German towns like Brunswick revised their guild regulations to exclude Wends and other non-German speakers. These distinctions continued to matter in daily life in these regions, but dissipated as use of the Slavic languages decreased. Culture. It was not until the Culture Wars of the High Renaissance that language moved closer to its modern role as a key determinant of national identity. Renewed tensions with the papacy around 1400 contributed to this, as did the renegotiation of imperial-papal relations through the concordats of the later 15th century. Critiques of papal corruption blended with the interests of humanists in articulating national origins and identity, because words and other outward manifestations like clothing were regarded as indicative of inner morality and character. Tropes that had already appeared in the 13th century emerged now in more virulent form. German was supposedly the most ancient and purest language, and a general marker of cultural superiority over the Welsch. This was a blanket pejorative term for all Latin foreigners, chiefly French and Italians, but also including on occasion Poles, Hungarians, and others. Criticism of cultural and sartorial values was an expression of deeper anxieties stirred by greater social mobility and the perceived erosion of the status distinctions delineating corporate groups. These pressures were most acute in towns. One manifestation was the series of sumptuary laws regulating clothing, such as that issued in Leipzig in 1452, which restricted the use of styles and fabrics in an attempt to stop servants being mistaken for masters. Another ordinance, from 1431, targeted an unauthorized group counterculture by forbidding journeymen to wear shoes of a common distinctive color. Efforts to regulate appearance stimulated the discussion of whether there was, or should be, a distinctive national dress. Konrad Keltis called for imperial legislation to encourage a more German appearance. Germans allegedly wore smart, restrained and simple clothes, reflecting their honesty and integrity. By contrast, the Welsh were slovenly and promiscuous, especially, of course, their women, who sported low-cut, garish dresses, jewelry, and ridiculous hairstyles. Hans Weigel's illustrated costume book, published in 1577, depicted a soberly dressed woman from Metz, in contrast to a brightly attired French woman, in a deliberate attempt to demonstrate that Metz was still German, despite having been captured by France in 1552. The discussion of national costume reveals the difficulties that Germans encountered in trying to define their identity through culture and ethnicity. Intellectuals could not agree whether they should don allegedly authentic Germanic garb or current fashions more in line with their present needs. In short, there was no actual national dress. As the Leipzig City Council remarked in 1595, "The clothes the people of the German nation wear almost always change from one year to the next." The same was true for other aspects of culture, like painting, music, literature, and architecture, all of which exhibited regional more than national characteristics. Beyond trumpeting the invention of printing as the Germans' gift to humanity, there was little else intellectuals agreed on as distinctly national about German culture. All these efforts missed the point. It was the empire's inclusive diversity that made it distinctive and enabled its numerous inhabitants to identify with it. Nowhere is this clearer than in attitudes to German speakers beyond the empire. In early modernity, there was a wider German-speaking cultural community which extended along the Baltic shore, through Polish Prussia and Courland, into Estonia and beyond. However, none of these peoples were considered politically German, despite some of them living in places once associated with the empire that in no way was considered a Greater Germany. The Baltic Germans likewise found it easier and more expedient to identify with their home province, while those in Poland regarded the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth as guarantor of their own identity and rights. Humanism. The humanist discussion of national identity raised consciousness of the distinction between the empire's traditional transnational character and its more specific association with Germany. Central to this debate was the rediscovery of Tacitus's Germania, written in AD 98. Few in the empire had read it before a manuscript copy was taken to Rome in 1451 and then rapidly disseminated through humanist intellectual exchange. A Latin printed edition appeared in 1470, followed by a German translation in 1526. The book's impact was magnified by the dearth of information on the early Germans. Tacitus, in fact, never visited Germania, but wrote an informed, fairly even-handed description of the German tribes, including the sensational story of Arminius, Hermann, who defeated Quinctilius Varus's Roman legions in the Teutoburg Forest in AD 9. Like all sophisticated texts, Germania could be read in multiple ways. Italian humanists seized on Tacitus's description of German vices of excessive eating and drinking as corroborating existing stereotypes. The German response was mixed. One strand took an anti-Roman course, exemplified by Ulrich von Hutten, who played on Tacitus's depiction of Germans as noble savages defeating decadent Romans in his own anti-papal polemics of the early 16th century. Combined with those advocating linguistic and cultural purity, this line of argument rapidly developed the trend to articulate a distinct German national identity in opposition to similar identities voiced elsewhere in Europe. The experience of the Church Council at Constance, 1414 to 1418, already fostered a sense of a Germania Nascio, which grew as a rallying cry against both papal tax demands and the Ottoman threat. The Reformation added impetus, but Hutten's critique was much broader than Luther's better-known appeal to the Christian nobility of the German nation, 1520, which was limited to church reform. These discussions made a lasting impact through providing concepts and images to express the new national idea. The female figure of Germania had appeared as a captive Amazon on Roman coins, but was reinvented by Maximilian I as mother of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation in the early 16th century. She remained the embodiment of the empire as virtuous and pacific, reappearing as a symbol of liberty during the 1848 revolution, before becoming militarized as a bloodthirsty fury in the late 19th century. Meanwhile, thanks to Tacitus, German humanists were able to remind their Italian counterparts that the Romans had never conquered Germany, whereas the Germans had plundered Rome. The coincidence of this discussion with the renewed sack of that city by Charles V's army in 1527 seemed to underscore their point. But it was not until 1643 that Hermann Conring drew the full, logical conclusions and rejected any connection between Rome and the empire, arguing that the ancient Roman Empire had collapsed long before Charlemagne was crowned emperor. However, for most people, Tacitus simply proved the long-standing argument of imperial translation that the Germans, as conquerors of Rome, were its worthy imperial successors. These arguments caused considerable problems for Protestants, who realized that the logic of anti-Romanism opened them to charges of being unpatriotic. The Roman Catholic humanist Johannes Cochlaeus directly accused Luther of this because his depiction of the Pope as Antichrist challenged the legitimacy of imperial rule and its glorious tradition of defending the Church. The Protestant theologian Philipp Melanchthon and the historian Johannes Schleiden responded by explicitly embracing imperial translation to support their calls for the emperor to renew the Church by embracing the Reformation. The idealization of medieval emperors continued to serve Protestant agendas into the mid-17th century by implying criticism of the current Habsburg emperors as beholden to the Pope. In short, the empire was too much part of Protestant Germans' identity to be jettisoned in their break with Rome. Instead, Protestant intellectuals and princes tried to appropriate German language and culture as their own, and to present Catholics as unpatriotic. In practice, their efforts fell far short of what later generations expected of true Germans. The fruitful society, Fruchtbringende Gesellschaft, established in 1617, was the most famous of these national cultural endeavors. Although dedicated to the purity of the German language, it accepted Scots, Swedes, Italians, and others as members, and published most of its works in Latin. German freedom. Mutual accusations of lack of patriotism peaked during the Thirty Years' War, with Protestants accusing Catholics of selling the empire to Spanish Jesuits and the Pope, while Catholics blamed Protestants for inviting in Danish, Swedish, and French invaders. The fact that both sides claimed to be upholding the imperial constitution drew attention to this as a possible bridge between them. The funeral sermon for Archbishop-Elector Anselm Casimir of Mainz in 1647 noted that it would have been politically advantageous for him to have accepted an alliance offer from France, yet he had remained steadfastly loyal to the emperor and empire. The elector's Lutheran neighbor, the Landgrave of Hessen-Darmstadt, praised him as a true patriot for his efforts at the Westphalian Peace Congress to persuade Catholic hardliners to offer Protestants more acceptable terms to end the war. While it might require modification, all believed the Constitution offered the best protection for their German freedom. This was broadly similar to other aristocratic expressions of freedom, such as Polish and Hungarian, liberty, freeborn Englishmen, and la liberté de la France. All combined demands for autonomy with claims to participate in politics. Those constituting the political nation should be free to pursue their lives without undue royal interference, yet were entitled to share government with the king. There were other concepts of freedom, but it would be wrong to divide these into rival elite and popular forms. Neither was inherently more progressive or democratic. Civic freedom often led to oligarchy, while supposedly aristocratic arguments could promote republican government. Symbols and arguments remained open to a variety of uses prior to the emergence of a more rigid left-right ideological spectrum after the French Revolution of 1789. The humanist articulation of German identity extrapolated liberties from Tacitus's account of the Germans as an unconquered free people. The parallel process of imperial reform provided a new institutional framework to embed these into the imperial constitution. Crucially, this entailed that German freedom depended on belonging to the empire rather than emancipation from it. This was a major factor blunting any potential for Protestantism to become a separatist political movement. Furthermore, it ensured that freedom was expressed as specific liberties, not uniform, equal, and universal liberty. Finally, it bound together the imperial estates and the corporate social groups, since all were mutually dependent in maintaining the empire as the collective guarantor of their own special status. It was this combination that made German freedom distinct from its equivalents in other countries, where writers claimed or invented broader underlying common liberties, such as national law, jus patrium in France, or the common custom of the realm, emerging in early 17th century England. Some German writers embraced elements of this, like Conring in the early 17th century, or the historian Jakob Paul von Gantling around 100 years later. However, they still inverted the standard pattern. Rather than championing an underlying set of universal freedoms, they celebrated the empire as an overarching system protecting numerous local and specific liberties. To most Germans, a universal system of freedoms was equated with tyranny, since it threatened their cherished distinctiveness. The Empire Speaks. Multiple Voices. The Empire's polycentric structure necessitated different ways of communicating identity to those in more centralized states. Without a single capital, the Empire always lacked the cultural synergies produced by the concentration of creative, political, and financial resources in a single dominant city like Paris or London. This, however, also brought with it unique strengths. The Empire avoided the cultural tensions between capital and province, court and country, found in other monarchies. Instead, cultural production and the expression of attachment diffused more evenly throughout the empire, extending a sense of ownership more broadly, both geographically and socially. It is perhaps doubtful that these conditions encouraged greater artistic creativity, as has been claimed. Nonetheless, the empire produced the two innovations of the early modern communications revolution: printing and a regular postal network. Political decentralization frustrated censorship and control, while the absence of a single capital distributed cultural activity, patronage, and educational opportunities more evenly. Modern Germany still benefits from having more theaters and opera houses than any other European country, while cultural life is also still fairly evenly spread in Austria and Italy. However, we should not exaggerate the level of activity nor its impact on the broader population. It is always easier to analyze images and symbols and to understand how they were received by their audiences. Both Carolingian and Ottonian rule are associated with a renaissance or revival and reinterpretation of classical antiquity, while similar, less extensive developments have been identified during the Staufer era. The Carolingian Renaissance was particularly important as the primary transmitter of ancient Roman imperial models and for the articulation of a Christian moralized politics. This gave Charlemagne and his successors an idea of what an imperial court should look like, but theirs was never a carbon copy of ancient Rome. Moreover, the Carolingian Renaissance did not penetrate far beyond the clergy. Indeed, many of the clergy implicitly criticized the emperor for failing to match their ideal of a Christian Roman monarch. The Carolingians made a lasting adaptation of imperial Rome to Frankish sensibilities in that their political-cultural practice was about presentation, not representation. The emperor needed to be present among a select, immediate audience of great lords, rather than be represented through a coherent strategy of images and propaganda intended for a wider but physically distant audience. Much of medieval imperial politics was about creating and managing opportunities for the emperor to engage personally with the political elite. This was a permanent structural characteristic, because the empire's monarchs remained itinerant into early modernity. Consequently, the earliest imperial symbols needed to be portable, and it was only under much changed circumstances that the Luxembourgs, and especially the Habsburgs, developed a representational court culture closer in essential form to both ancient Rome and their European monarchical contemporaries. Signs. The imperial crown was the empire's most obvious and enduring symbol. As in so many ways, Charlemagne set an important precedent in using a crown denoting divine reward for true faith, rather than the ancient Roman practice of a laurel wreath symbolizing military victory. Custom maintained that the Charles crown, Karlskrona, was always used after 800. The surviving imperial crown is certainly very old, but even by the 15th century, some doubted it was actually Charlemagne's. Multiple detailed studies by art historians have failed to establish exactly when it was made, as it was clearly modified several times. The general consensus remains that it was produced for either Otto I's coronation in 962 or that of his son, Otto II, as co-emperor in 967. The octagonal design is said to represent Jerusalem, while each plate is richly decorated with images of Christ and Old Testament kings. The crown is closed by an arch from front to back, denoting its imperial status, in contrast to open diadems of mere kings. It was reserved for imperial coronations by the 12th century, with separate royal crowns used in German, Italian, and Burgundian coronations. These secondary crowns never attained the same semi-sacral quality and were often melted down or pawned. There were additional private crowns, symbolizing purely secular authority. These were scarcely royal daywear. Rudolf II's gold crown from 1602 weighs 3.9 kilograms. Although not the last to be made, Rudolf's crown survived to become the Habsburgs' dynastic symbol and was used on a revised coat of arms to denote their new Austrian imperial status in 1804. Many other treasures accumulated by the 13th century. Like the crown, several existed in multiple copies or were replaced or altered. Byzantine influence was strong thanks to Constantinople's association with ancient Rome and its significance as a source of holy relics. However, the empire's rulers and craftsmen displayed innovation of their own. The Ottonians invented the crowned cross, combining secular and spiritual images to underscore their holy mission. Otto I added a cross to the imperial orb, Reichsapfel, which by the 11th century had replaced the staff as the symbol of earthly rule. The holy lance, Sacra Lancia, contained the victory-bringing nail said to have come from Christ's cross. It had been acquired around 925 by Henry I from Rudolf II of Burgundy. Its potency as a symbol of divinely ordained rule was heightened through association with the Ottonian victory over the Magyars at Lechfeld in 955 and over the Roman rebels in 1001. Around 1000, Otto III sent copies to Boleslav Chrobry and, possibly, Stephen of Hungary as part of his recognition of them as the empire's junior partners. Three swords became part of the imperial insignia, including the Gladius Caroli Magni that was said to be part of Charlemagne's booty taken from the Avars, having previously belonged to Attila the Hun, though it was most likely made a century later using an East European saber. It was worn by emperors at their coronation. The imperial cross is a spectacular item, allegedly containing a piece of Christ's cross once belonging to Charlemagne. Again, its provenance is controversial, but it certainly played an important part in religious processions by the 11th century. Other important relics included an alleged thorn from Christ's crown, a tooth from John the Baptist, a chip from Christ's crib, a piece from his carpenter's apron, the tablecloth from the Last Supper, and, for once genuine, Charlemagne's own Bible, as well as St. Stephen's purse containing that saint's blood, which was placed on a table during royal coronations in Aachen. The sacral significance of these items emphasized the emperor's position as Christendom's preeminent ruler and his holy mission. However, some items from other cultures were incorporated, notably the spectacular coronation robes with their palm tree and camel motifs made by Islamic craftsmen in Sicily, which were acquired by the Staufers, and the red Chinese silk eagle dalmatic embroidered with 68 eagle medallions, probably made for Louis IV. By that point, the imperial insignia formed a recognized collection recorded in inventories that did not question them as both authentic and timeless objects. Albrecht Dürer's painting of Charlemagne from 1510 shows the emperor wearing the imperial crown, the eagle dalmatic, and the Islamic robes. Seals were another potent symbol, used to authenticate charters and other documents issued by the imperial chancellery. Carolingian seals and coins followed ancient Roman practice in showing the ruler's head in profile. This practice continued in West Francia until the end of the Carolingian era, but had already shifted in the East by 899 to show the monarch's whole body posed in profile as a triumphant warrior. The Ottonians invented a new form in 962, showing the emperor frontally, enthroned, crowned, and holding a scepter and orb as symbols of majesty. Later Ottonian seals got bigger, thicker, and more imposing, while after 998, the Ottonian emperors began issuing metallic seals like popes, thereby elevating important charters to golden bulls. The Ottonian style became the model for royal seals across Europe. Ottonian seals and court liturgy reflected the changed, more elevated and sacral monarchical ideal, adding images emphasizing the ruler's proximity to God, alongside the more traditional prayers for divine protection. Whereas Carolingian images often showed the emperor surrounded by nobles or intellectuals, those of the Salian era reflected the more command-style monarchy by placing the emperor apart, often as a significantly larger figure than his retinue. The sacral element waned after the 1070s, and monarchs appeared more obviously as mortals, especially in regnal and dynastic sequences of miniature portraits. Images became increasingly lifelike after 1300, perhaps in reaction to the impostors claiming to be the long-dead Frederick II, as well as reflecting new ideas of the self. Charles IV had over 70 portraits of himself distributed systematically across the empire, Again, this reflected a fundamental political shift. As imperial rule came to rest in hereditary territorial possessions under the Luxembourgs, emperors no longer showed themselves so often directly to their important subjects through the traditional royal progress. Portraits offered an easily portable substitute. Charles is presented recognizably with large eyes, a high forehead, and high cheekbones. His son Sigismund was also shown distinctively in portraiture with a mass of blonde hair and a forked beard. Presentation as individuals heightened the significance of the authentic, unchanging insignia symbolizing the empire's enduring character. All the Luxembourg portraits, like those by Durer, show each emperor wearing the same imperial crown. While the crown and royal portraits identified the monarch, the empire increasingly became associated with the image of an eagle. Eagles already symbolized empires and armies in the ancient world and formed part of Byzantine iconography. An imperial eagle adorned the palace in Aachen, at least by the time of the humiliating raid by the West Frankish king Lothar in 978, and also appeared atop Otto III's orb. It is clearly associated with the emperor from Frederick I Barbarossa onwards, appearing on all important items associated with the emperor, like his coat of arms, insignia, coins, tents, and battle flag. The eagle remained single-headed until the later 12th century, when double-headed versions appeared on civic coats of arms and devices associated with the emperor. By the mid-14th century, the double eagle was firmly fixed as an imperial bird, distinguishing it from single-headed royal or princely eagles. Sigismund used a single-headed eagle as king before adopting a double-headed one at his imperial coronation in 1433, but this practice ceased with Maximilian I's adoption of the elected imperial title in 1508. Maximilian fixed the double eagle to the Habsburg coat of arms, making it a dynastic symbol as well. This was briefly contested in the 1740s by Charles VII, the one non-Habsburg emperor of early modernity, who had the double eagle painted onto Bavarian army flags. Sigismund added halos for the eagle's heads in 1433 to symbolize the empire's holy character, as well as a crown. After 1612, the imperial vicars used an uncrowned double eagle in their periods of office during imperial interregna. The double eagle image spread rapidly throughout the 15th century, being embraced by groups as diverse as German students at Bologna University to members of the Hanseatic League, as well as being disseminated in print as broadsheets or illustrations in books about the empire. The rise of the imperial princes proliferated other single-headed eagles. In most cases, the eagle changed from the original imperial black to red, Brandenburg, Tyrol, or red and white striped, Hessen, Thuringia. The Teutonic Order adopted a black eagle before this bird became the empire's primary symbol, and the black eagle was carried over to Prussia once the Hohenzollerns were raised as kings in 1701. Savoy also retained a black eagle into the 19th century, while Tuscany adopted a black double eagle combined with the Tuscan arms during the era of Habsburg rule. The eagle had originally been golden until the late 13th century, when gold became the most common color for any background field, for example on flags or coats of arms. The papacy adopted the purple of ancient Rome, but the empire favored gold, black, red, and white, although in no firm combination. The Stauffer imperial battle flag was red with a white cross, persisting today as the Swiss flag. The red-white combination was also adopted by numerous princely dynasties and imperial cities. The century after 1450 saw rapid change in imperial imagery, reflecting both a transition to a more formalized mixed monarchy, the establishment of Habsburg imperial rule, and the invention of new media like printing. Older elements, like the Christian hero, persisted into Maximilian I's reign, but were joined by revived classical images, notably the emperor as Hercules or as Jupiter presiding over a new Olympus. Although pagan, such symbols acquired new value through Renaissance humanism, which cemented their association with political virtues like justice, clemency, and peace. These symbols were also attractive after the Reformation, which made some Christian imagery politically problematic in a state with two recognized faiths. The classical world also supplied numerous non-human motifs that could be employed to symbolize the empire's more collective character extending beyond just its monarch. For example, the electors were already described in the Golden Bull of 1356 as the pillars of the empire. Pillars, obelisks, and columns all symbolized solidity, peace, and justice. Other images conveyed more partisan interpretations, reflecting the imperial constitution's contested character through the 16th and 17th centuries. For example, presenting the empire as a ship suggested it required a strong emperor as helmsman. Images of the emperor diverged under the Habsburgs. Their status as dynasts, ruling their own extensive hereditary possessions, was represented in magnificent portraits, showing them generally full length, but almost always alone, except for collective family portraits. When shown in their imperial role, they were surrounded by the electors, or representatives of all the imperial estates. The political changes are further reflected in attempts to fix the increasingly complex status hierarchy in a new device known as the Quaternionen, showing the imperial estates as figures or heraldic devices, and first appearing in a fresco created in Frankfurt for Sigismund around 1414. Written descriptions soon spread, followed by printed engravings from the mid-15th century that generally displayed the estates against a background of a black double eagle. The electors were either omitted or shown as a rank of seven figures at the top. The other status groups followed in sequence below: dukes, margraves, landgraves, burgraves, counts, lords, knights, imperial cities, villages, and peasants. The Quaternionen were always schematic. There were invariably more in reality than the four members displayed for each group, while the locations presented as villages and peasants were often actually additional towns. Nonetheless, these images remained very popular until about 1600, when they were displaced by more accurate information on the actual composition of the imperial estates, especially the printed lists of those summoned to the Reichstag, as well as by published maps and descriptions of the empire. Symbolic innovation declined after the mid-16th century, again reflecting the end of imperial reform and the broadly stable character of the empire's constitution thereafter. The triumphal arches used by Maximilian II, 1570, and Matthias, 1612, for their entries into Nuremberg were virtually identical to that erected for Charles V in 1541. The scale and scope of artistic patronage certainly broadened under Rudolf II, but much of it was too highbrow and esoteric to serve as effective propaganda. The most enduring creation was a heightened image of the emperor as victorious conqueror of the Turks and defender of the peace, an image that returned with the renewed wars against the Ottomans in the later 17th century. Habsburg imperial imagery became more overtly Catholic around 1600, leaving no doubt of the emperor's own faith. However, Ferdinand III already sought to recover the more neutral, cross-confessional position that had been occupied by his predecessors in the mid to late 16th century, presenting himself as Solomon, symbolizing wisdom and virtue rather than zealotry. Piety was increasingly turned outwards against external enemies, notably Louis XIV, who was criticized as disturbing Christendom's peace in contrast to the emperor as guarantor of order. Ferdinand also embraced the new artistic forms associated with the Baroque, notably opera, and displayed some talent as a musician and composer himself. However, these innovations increasingly reflected changing taste and Habsburg dynastic objectives, but produced no new representations of the empire. Locations. Places also acquired symbolic importance through events like royal elections, coronations, and assemblies, as well as more permanently as palaces or tombs. It was characteristic of the empire's political order that it used multiple locations rather than a single capital. The number of places with imperial associations grew over time, especially with the changes of ruling dynasty into early modernity, since each royal family had a different geographical power base. Although some locations fell out of use, many never lost their significance entirely, while others, like monasteries or towns, unilaterally expressed their attachment to the empire through furnishing emperor's halls, Kaisersäle, and imperial portrait galleries. Locations of symbolic importance were used throughout the empire, but the preference for Germany was already obvious under the Carolingians. Aachen, in the extreme west of Germany, was the favored royal palace and place of royal coronations for most of the Middle Ages. Charlemagne's stone throne, as well as the rather more portable imperial Bible and St. Stephen's purse, were stored here, while the rest of the insignia traveled with the emperor. After the renewed civil wars around 1100, Henry V stored the insignia in his strong castle of Trifels in the Palatinate. They resumed their travels under the Staufers before being entrusted to the Cistercian monks at Eusatal Monastery until 1273, when they were scattered to various castles except for coronations. The move to more territorially based imperial rule under Charles IV was reflected in the concentration of the insignia, first in St. Vitus Cathedral in Prague, and then in the Karlstein Castle between 1356 and 1421. The Hussite insurrection prompted their removal to Nuremberg, which remained the official repository until the French Revolutionary Wars. The absence of a permanent capital discouraged the construction of the kind of representational buildings found in other European monarchies. An itinerant emperor needed lots of palaces and could not invest heavily in a single site. Some medieval construction was nevertheless very impressive. Charlemagne and Otto III commissioned deliberately imposing buildings at Aachen, while the Ottonians developed Goslar, and the Salians constructed Speyer's huge cathedral as their royal tomb. The difference only really became noticeable in early modernity, when other monarchies built lavish palaces like the Escorial in Spain and Versailles in France, or, in Russia's case, an entirely new capital at St. Petersburg. The contrast grew more obvious with the proliferation of fashionable new princely residences at Ludwigsburg, Herrenhausen, Nymphenburg, and elsewhere across Germany. From 1663, the permanent Reichstag continued to meet in Regensburg's old Gothic town hall, suggesting to some visitors that the empire was stuck in the distant past. The city's construction of a new hall immediately next door, at the beginning of the 18th century, accentuated the distinction between old and new.